The town may be kind of small, but these folks have big smiles and big hearts. And they know what it is to have simple fun down our way, where old-fashioned singing and homey gatherings make living mighty pleasant.
I'm the guy in the glasses.
There you go.
Waving at you.
Now I can hear you, and now I see you.
Okay, Rob, give it a go.
And this is me. I'm Rob. I am in the non-glasses and the non-pink shirt.
It's salmon, guys. Let's go with salmon, please.
Salmon. Salmon-colored shirt.
Okay, now I can hear. Keep rolling.
Welcome to Abandoned Albums, the documentary podcast where we take a closer look at some albums that may have been forgotten about over time, and some albums you might not even know existed. I'm your host, Keith R. Higgins, and joining me, as always, is Rob Janicki. Hey, Rob.
Hey, Keith. How are you?
I am doing okay, Rob. I am doing okay. I got to tell you, though, it is hotter than H.E. double hockey sticks. On this episode of Abandoned Albums, we talk with Gary Myrick, singer-songwriter and Texas guitar slinger. Gary's career has included a chance encounter with Jimi Hendrix, replacing Stevie Ray Vaughan in the band Cracker Jack, recording a number one hit song known around the world, and playing with founding members of both The Clash and The Sex Pistols, in addition to his own solo work. Rob and I got the chance to talk with Gary about how the band Havana 3AM came to be and their brilliant 1990 self-titled debut album. So here's our conversation with Gary Myrick about Havana 3AM and a whole lot of other things, including what he's up to today. Well, welcome, Gary. Thank you. My apologies for the technical glitches, and I sincerely appreciate your patience. Thank you.
Oh, it's no problem, brother. No worries at all.
Cool.
I don't even know where to begin. I think you've got an amazing career.
Don't say that.
No. have an amazing career. I apologize. Have an amazing career. And
yeah,
just looking
it's
through.
Still going. It's and, not done.
It absolutely is. Very far from done.
I appreciate that. You know, I've been very lucky to do and played with so many different people and done my own. You know, I now have like over 10 albums out of my own. And then, you know, have been lucky enough to play with other really great people. I'm grateful.
What's interesting, what really made my jaw drop initially, replacing Stevie Ray Vaughan, and that's pretty fucking intense.
Well, you know what the best thing about that is? It looks incredible on the resume. That's the best thing about it. I mean, I knew Stevie. Stevie was playing in a band in Austin in 1972 called Cracker Jack. And they had two guitarists. Another one was named Robin Seiler, who is also passed. And Uncle John Turner was the drummer. And Uncle John was the original drummer for the Johnny Winter Trio.
Wow.
And Tommy Shannon, who later on was in Double Trouble, bass player, was playing bass in Cracker Jack. So I had my own band in Dallas, and I was playing a place called The Cellar, which was a wild joint, downtown Dallas. Mm-hmm. Every bouncer had a gun on.
Wow.
Good God.
In fact, a bullet flew over my head one night, for real. They were shooting at me.
I was going to ask, yeah.
Some guy hit his gun on a table, like, you know, like a dumbass, and it went pew, and I went, hey, can you not do that? I'm trying to live here and play some songs. What the hell? It was a wild joint. I'm doing all my own material, which was, you know, not many people were doing in Texas at that time. Nobody was doing their own stuff. I mean, some people were, but not many. So Uncle John came in that club, and I'd met him a long time ago before that, and I'd been down to Austin with another band of mine earlier. So Uncle John said, "Hey, we need a guitar player. Would you like to come down to Austin and join Cracker Jack?" And seeing that Cracker Jack had a really great reputation, and because they were doing their own thing, it was like blues rock, and they were the biggest band in Austin. So I thought, well, this will be great fun. I said, yeah. You know, Stevie hadn't made any records or any, you know, none of us had made any record except for Uncle John and Tommy were on the Johnny Winter stuff.
Okay.
And so I thought it would be a really good thing for me to also, you know, really do some blues rock and, you know, also make some good money because they were making really good money. Yeah. For the times. We were making like $1,000 a night, which was in 72 with no records out. That was fantastic, you know, that went a long way because you could rent a house for like, you know, $200 in Austin, you know, back in the day. And it was a hippie town. It was really it was just music, had a great blues scene. And it also was just it was a lot smaller. It's not anything like that now. I mean, you know, it's still, you know, a liberal minded town, but you know, they don't pay their musicians anymore. I mean, locally, it's bad. It's bad for the new guys that are trying to do something. They don't get treated right, and it's not cool.
No.
But nevertheless, I went down there. I replaced Stevie. I don't know why. Maybe he was drunk. I don't know. I don't know what was going on. And then we met again later on and played some song after I was on Epic Records and he was on Epic Records. And we played some shows in the Midwest and, you know, had some talks, and it was a very sweet guy, very nice guy, you know, a gentle soul. And of course a great guitar player, we all know. So that was it. That was it. That's how I replaced Stevie Ray Vaughan.
Our first interview with, do you know who Jimmy Ashurst is? He's a bass player. He was in a band called Broken Homes. He then went on to play with Izzy Stradlin, Buck Cherry, in any event. Do you know who Don Harvey is, the drummer?
No.
He's from Austin, and Jimmy was always concerned about his bass playing. He thought he sucked or whatever, and he was always afraid that he was going to get fired. So they're recording their first record, and they bring in Don Harvey, who's from Austin. The quote Jimmy said in the interview was, he's like, "I'm in there with a bunch of musicians, and they bring in a drummer from Austin, and these guys from Texas can play.
You know what? We don't have anything to do but practice. So we better learn our shit or forget it.
Yeah.
Hit the road. If you got to learn your stuff." And I'm telling young musicians that. I said, "Dude, you got to be practicing. You got to listen to everything, and you got to practice every day of your life. For the rest of your life." That's the deal. Also, there's a great history in Texas. So we're all, you know, we have to live up to it, or, you know, it's not going to work out.
So fast forward a few years after replacing Stevie Ray Vaughan in Cracker Jack, and you end up in the studio with John Waite, former frontman for the Babies.
Yeah.
And you're working on his album, No Breaks, which, of course, contains the massive hit single, Missing You.
Well, everybody knows that song, and you know, we had a number one. We didn't know. We had no idea. I wrote four songs on the album, and then I put the whole thing together with John, and I both put the whole thing together. I had a drummer, Curly Smith, who was also from Austin originally, and he played all the drums on it. Great drummer. And he's still out there playing. And then Donnie Nassoff was a bass player that John had worked with a lot. He was a very sweet guy, good guy. And so we just went into rehearsals. We would write some in rehearsals separately, together. And then we did Missing You as we were recording the album. And then I had a solo album to do on Geffen. And, you know, we really always wanted to go out and tour together. And it's a shame we didn't, because a lot of people really, you know, liked the guitar on that record. I should, you know, gone out and played it, but it didn't work out that way. You know, to this day, when you say missing you, you know, to have a number one song in your career anytime is really, you know, fantastic.
I was a teenager in the mid 80s and I remember that song really, really well, but I was more into underground rock, alternative punk rock, things like that. So
me too, but I could do, you know, I could do Missing You too. I mean,
oh, sure.
You know, and I mean, I even played with Jackson Browne too. You know, I mean, I could play with whatever the artist was part of. I could probably adapt to it, even though I was more into the more underground and wilder music.
You have this history, and leading up to someone like me, when I discovered you, it was through Havana 3 AM. Had all this punk influence kind of rockabilly stuff, which was amazing. And it was so different at the time. And I remember finding that record and being a fan of The Clash, knowing that Paul was on the record. Like, I think that's probably what got it into the mainstream.
It is.
And then when people heard it, they were like, holy shit, this is a great album. Does that record hold a place for you? That's
it was a great time. I met Paul and Nigel, the singer. Nigel was in a band called Whirlwind in England, and they opened for The Clash, like many gigs, like on tour, and they were a full-on rockabilly band. Nigel was the lead singer of that band, and they have quite a few records. You might want to do a little research on Whirlwind. You might dig it.
I will.
So he's still well-known in the rockabilly scene in England, but he passed away in Havana 3 a.m. from cancer, which devastated us, you know, and he was the sweetest guy you'd ever meet.
Motorcycle and scooter on the fashion scene. Black leather favored by Mike, the motorcyclist, for protection at speed. Fitted beige jacket in corduroy favored by Richard for scooter riding. Get into the right gear. Always wear a safety helmet.
We were all into motorcycles. That's kind of how we met. I was playing some guitar backing up Steve Jones from the Sex Pistols.
Sure.
Steve had a solo album out. Mercy was the name of the album. And he had played all the guitar on the album and he needed to go out on tour. I had met Steve and had said, if you ever needed any, you know, guitar to back you up or whatever, just holler. And he also was into motorcycles. So, and I'd been riding for, you know, years before that. Paul and Nigel ride into town from El Paso, Texas, and I'm hanging out with Steve Jones to do this tour. And I meet Nigel and Paul, and we all go riding. We all had Harleys. And so we went out riding, not really talking about music, you know, just hanging, really. Mm-hmm. Somehow we started talking about music one day. And we said, I said, well, maybe we should try to write some songs. And if we think they're any good, let's cut a little demo or something. And, you know, if they're not, okay, that's cool. Nobody, no hard feelings, because they wanted to start a band. And I wanted to play with them because I liked them. And I also get, you know, got along great with English people. I don't know why. You know, they have a thing about Texans. They like Texans. You know, they imagine we're all in cowboy hats and got six.
Old school Americana. Yeah, yeah.
And they were really into, you know, Paul's into spaghetti Western and surf guitar, which I, you know, play. And, you know, I like that stuff too. And I could do that. And so we kind of had a concept of rockabilly, punk, spaghetti Western, and Latin overtones.
Yeah, absolutely.
Havana. That's where Havana came. Mm-hmm. You know, and Havana 3 AM is actually a Perez Prado, who is a Havana artist. That was the name of one of his albums. So we stole that name.
I didn't know that.
I was going
to
ask.
Which I still think to this day, that's a great name.
Yeah.
They asked me to come to London. So I go to London. We rehearsed. They had a drummer over there. I wished we had our American drummer, because I had a great drummer. His name was Steve Klong. He was an incredible drummer. And then he passed away from cancer also.
Oh, wow.
I know. It's devastating. My list is insane of people I've lost through the years, but I'm sure everybody's is. So I go to London and they say, do you want to go on tour? And I said, yeah, sure. Let's go. Let's play. And so we wrote a whole album, all three of us, and me, Nigel, and Paul. And we were doing it in Paul's basement. Paul's wife was managing us, which can be a little sketchy, but it worked out. We all got paid. That's what Nigel said to me. He said, well, at least we're making money. And I said, yeah, that's right. If we get paid, then it's working out. So anyhow, we went on tour. We went through Spain three times, France, Germany, England. We went on tour with Big Audio Dynamite, and we hadn't made a record yet.
Yeah.
But we see it was that Clash connection that
absolutely
gave the audience right away.
Yeah.
Which we appreciated. And I, you know, I totally give it to Paul for that. We were having a great time. And then we got an offer to do the record in Japan. So we fly over to Japan and we make the album with an engineer who can't speak any English.
Are you kidding me?
I know. Yeah. And then we get an interpreter. Okay. They fly us with an interpreter through the whole thing.
Holy shit.
He's traveling around with us everywhere. We go to a bar, he's with us, which was really great because I'd never been to Japan and I thought it was amazing. And I like the Japanese, and they're just, you know, it's an awesome thing. If you've never been to Japan, it's an incredible place.
And
I love the people. And anyhow, and they're also super rock and roll people and rockabilly and, you know, everything. They love it all. We go over there, we cut the album, we all produce it. We have an interpreter talking to the engineer through the whole thing. I'll say, look, I need to get my guitar to sound like this and blah, blah, blah. And then he tells him, and then we make the whole record.
The record
company is a Japanese label. They said, you guys can have the master tapes.
Wow.
Then you can, you know, go to America or England and license it to a label. So we owned the record, and which was cool.
Very rare.
At that time, that was kind of rare.
Yeah.
And it was kind of the beginning of owning your own album and not being screwed by the record company. So we went back to England and then got an offer from IRS Records, which was Miles Copeland.
Yep.
Stuart Copeland's brother owned that label. And then we put it out and we went, started going on tour again in America and Canada. And we went back to Japan to play too. So that, and so we had a blast and we were having a great time. And we were all singing on stage. That was really kind of cool. We would all sing together. And that had a vibe that was really, really cool. And then I played the shit out of my guitar. I got to really, you know, I got to really do the spaghetti western whammy bar and, you know, the whole thing that I do love doing. Mm-hmm. But we had a great, great time.
I'm glad you use the word vibe because that's what that record is. It's got just incredible vibe throughout. It's got an amazing sound and Reach the Rock as a song. All the songs, I mean, I'm a fan, so, you know, I might be biased, but I think all the songs are really strong. But that song, had it been pushed, I think, and maybe I blame, you know, record companies for this often, had that been pushed, especially at the time it came out, I mean, that song should have been gigantic.
I agree. And I still, you know, play that song live.
Yeah, I've heard, and it's on your latest album, your reinvented version of it.
Yeah, yeah. I did a 12-string acoustic album.
You just released, what was it, this year?
Yeah. And it was all recorded analog, even though most of my records are analog anyway. But, you know, now that when digital came in, I kind of, you know, I mean, of course, I use digital for certain things, but I wanted to return back to the sound of vinyl and make sure I could get that. And I knew how to do that. So I wanted to do a solo record that was completely just acoustic guitar. And I wanted to do 12 string to give it. I'm kind of a fan of some of the old blues, like a Lead Belly, just played 12 string blues. I didn't make really what would be called a fully traditional blues record, but it has that element, I think.
Mr. Microphone.
Hey, what's that?
The cordless microphone that actually puts your voice on the radio. Broadcast over any FM car radio.
Hey, good looking. We'll be back to pick you up later.
It's practical and great fun for the whole family.
And I recorded it all on what would be called a ribbon microphone. So that's a microphone that they would use, say, in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. And people would record often on just one microphone.
Right.
Bands would just lean in for solos if it was acoustic, you know, and they would do that in Nashville too, like at the Grand Ole Opry. There's one big microphone and everybody's standing around it, you know, acoustic bands.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to do something that was with that one microphone. So I did my research and I found out it was a ribbon microphone. And I have some friends here in LA that know all the technical, you know, info. So
right.
Anyhow, I did reach the Rock.
That's on the record Forever, where it's the name of the yeah. recent album. And to me, the record sounds really intimate. It sounds, it almost sounds like if you listen to it, especially with headphones, you kind of feel like you were there. It's got that really, really comfortable, intimate sound.
That sound of vinyl.
Yeah.
And that's why some of our favorite records on the earth were done on vinyl. And some of the really old stuff, there's a sound to it. And there's, and that, you know, people call it the sound of vinyl, but really it's more, it's much more than that. It's the sound of the tape. It's the way the studios were made with mm-hmm. kinds of boards, all this stuff. So, you know, that's, and I even started my own little record company called Sound of Vinyl Records. And I put it out on my own little label.
That's really smart. And Keith and I were just talking about this, where we talk about it a lot, but the sound of vinyl and the way it makes people feel, because music, you know, listening to music is more of an experience, or should be more of an experience, an overall experience. You know, you got the visual, you got the artwork when you listen to vinyl, but the sound of it, it's got that experience where you you feel music more than you hear it when it's recorded that way, I think.
I think so. Well, you know, I think everyone, I mean, even the youngest kids agree, vinyl sounds better. We tried everything. We tried DATs, we did CDs, we've done this, and, you know, we've done Pro Tools. Now, Pro Tools is great, and I'm not against any Pro Tools-ism, because, you know, a real good trick is to record analog and then download it into Pro Tools for editing.
Yep.
The sound of vinyl records, I mean, every Led Zeppelin record was done, you know, on the tape in a studio, a recording studio that was all analog. That stuff sounds incredible. And you go down the list to Sgt. Pepper or the Jimi Hendrix Experience. That stuff's incredible, and it's always going to be incredible. So it helps the music a lot to live on, because it's a quality, it's an emotional thing.
There's a warmth and texture from those, and that just is not translated.
There is. There's a warmth and texture.
You know, there's a different attitude, a mentality when you're recording the tape. You know you don't have 1,000 chances, you know, to get it just right, you know, because it can be fixed in editing and you can use Pro Tools and you can change. So when you're going to tape, you know, you got to nail it. Might make even play better because you have that kind of somewhere in the back of your head that I got to nail this. Is that, do you find that to be true?
There is an element of that.
Yeah.
Of course you could take a million takes if you had to, but in the old days they would get a razor blade, mm-hmm. cut the tape to do edits. Now, and that's a talent unto itself, because if you mess up, you could screw up the whole track and ruin it. You could ruin it. So there are still guys that can do that, but that's the way editing was done back in those days, which worked. It worked, but it's dangerous. It was, you know, whoa, he's cutting the tape. What are we doing? And guys came through every time. I never had it not work. You know, it's a magical thing of the sound of vinyl.
When I've listened to some of those early Clapton solo records, and I hear some bum notes, and they left them in there, and I think that adds to the texture and the warmth.
Dude, if you go back and listen to some of the oldest blues, there are mistakes all over the place. And blues aficionados who really love the blues wouldn't trade those mistakes for $1 million. Those mistakes often become desirable. And that's what you're talking about. You heard that on an Eric Clapton record, and he, you know, he probably went, well, it's a mistake, but it's kind of cool. Let's leave it. That's what we would say in the day. We'd go, well, that's a mistake, but it's cool. It's kind of
cool. Works. Yeah.
So let's just leave it.
People are just now used to hearing things with you know, just precision and perfection. And, you know, technically maybe that's good, but there's no emotion in that. There's no real feel. When you go see a band live, no one's perfect. Everyone, a singer will miss a lyric, a guitar player will miss a note. It just kind of adds to the experience, I think.
It's honest. It's real. I mean, I've made a bunch of records, but my favorite thing is to play live.
Are you going to be touring this record? Are you going to go out on the road for this one?
I have a little project that, you know, do you know the band King's X?
Sure.
Okay. Doug Pinnick, the bass player. I found out they used to do some of my songs off of my first album when they got started. And so Doug and I talked about doing some playing, and he had a drummer that I also had worked with. So recently we went into Doug's garage, which somehow sounds great. We don't know how that's possible, but it does. Mm-hmm. We went in there and we've decided to, you know, cut some tracks. So we're kind of in the midst of recording some songs that we're writing together. And that's called Miles Per Hour, like, you know, MPH. And that would be Myrick, Pinnick, Hansen. Hansen's the drummer. We're probably going to be releasing that. And it's super electric. I went from my acoustic thing, which, you know, and I'll do an acoustic gig any old time. And I may do a second record, like a part two of Forever. I'm going, you know, back to all my electric whammy bars and blues notes and feedback. Tons of feedback. Here we go.
Damn, that was, I don't even know what to say.
That's not acoustic, by the
way. No, that is the opposite.
I just wanted you to get a taste of kind of the vibe of...
You know, Gary, that's how they get people addicted to drugs. They just give them a little taste.
That's right. I want you guys, I want everybody to be addicted to that sound.
Talking about the other albums with those vibes, like this one has its own, and you get it within seconds of the you know, of you starting to play that. So is there an album in the works? Is there something coming out?
We sure hope so. But right now, we're in the early stages. So we're just writing. We're going to record at Doug's house about, 3 or 4 songs. You know, we've discussed making a whole record. I don't know when exactly it's going to be out, or, you know, we don't really have a record company for it yet. We'll see. We'll see. Yeah. But musically, it's the thing about it that we really like is the combination of the trio is really strong, and it's really, we all get along great, and everybody is a nice person. I mean, it's at me, maybe. but I mean, you know what I mean? We really want to really get along and be happy and be, you know, have fun. Having fun is kind of important, you know?
A little bit.
So we don't know when it's going to come out. We don't really know. We just want to do it.
I mean, that's one thing rock and roll is missing is a good power trio.
Introducing Kush, the comfortable nighttime companion. Anatomically contoured to gently support and cushion the weight of a woman's breasts, Kush maintains a more natural shape while resting on your side.
Who are some of your favorite guitar players?
I have quite a few favorites, but my absolute favorite is Jimi Hendrix. And I got incredibly lucky when I was 16 years old and I saw Jimi Hendrix play. And then I went to the hotel where we heard Jimmy and the Experience were staying. We go into the Hyatt in Dallas. No security throwing us out or anything. It wasn't a problem. Nobody seemed to care. So a bunch of kids running in. So we go in. We're all running up and down the halls, wondering where they're, what room they're in. It doesn't even make sense what we're doing. And I get away from the group of kids, just, I think it, by accident. I don't even remember why. You know how hotels, there's just long walls and a million rooms. I'm just leaning on a wall. Right across from me, there's a hotel door. And that door opened up and Jimi Hendrix stepped out of that room and talked to me for like 5-8 minutes by myself.
Wow.
It was incredible. Yeah. It was like, it's one of my most fond memories. And let me tell you, Jimi Hendrix was the nicest guy. And he was the most soft-spoken, easygoing. If anybody looked like a god to a 16-year-old kid, he did.
Yeah.
And then turn out to be super nice that I could talk to. He had music playing in his room. So the door is open. He's in the hallway talking to me. I hear music coming out of there, and it was the Jeff Beck Truth album, the first Jeff Beck solo album.
Wow.
So it was an incredible moment.
Gary, do you remember what you and Jimmy, like, because Jimmy and I are on a first name basis. Do you remember what you and Jimmy talked about by chance?
All I know is I probably told him how much I loved his music and, you know, just typical fan stuff.
Sure.
I love your music, man. Yeah. You know, I love you, man. Or who knows what I said? Who knows? All I know is I was just enamored in every way. And so not disappointed at all.
That's awesome.
That's very cool.
It meant so much to me. And I'll never forget it. And God bless you. Beautiful journey.
Yeah. Your experience with Hendrix, I'm sure you've had kids come up to you and have and just be like, man, I love your shit. And that's got to be, I'm going to presuppose that you share the same kindness to those that come up to you that Jimi Hendrix showed. Yeah.
He taught me that lesson.
Yeah.
And I never forgot it. And I've even said it to young musicians, man, whatever you do, be nice to your fans. That whatever you think, be cool, be nice, talk to them. It's that simple, really. Everybody seems to go, yeah, right on, you know? And I go, you know, if Hendrix could talk to me, you better talk to your fans, you know?
The high horse kind of thing doesn't matter.
It doesn't fly. So just, you know, cool. Be cool.
Yeah.
I had a drummer. He always go, be cool, bitch. I went right on. Yeah.
That's a good album title.
That is a good album title. I played guitar on the last album that Wilson Pickett, the Wicked Pickett, made. It was called American Soul Man. And I was so lucky to be asked because I thought he was amazing. He was an incredible singer.
Absolutely.
Yeah. A real soul singer.
Yep.
And Hendrix played guitar for him for a while, too.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
I got to play decades later, of course, guitar for him on his album. And I always go, wow, Hendrix played for that. I got to play for that guy, too. You know,
you have an amazing resume.
I think I'm going to start a new game. Everybody knows the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon game. Well, I'm going to start the 6 degrees of Gary Myrick game because at least in music, you can point and connect the dots.
Well, you know what, bro? Stay grateful. About everything.
Yeah.
Everything. It could be so much worse.
You're not wrong.
You are not wrong at all.
Stay grateful.
And so, on that note, I am so grateful for your time.
It was really fun talking to you guys.
Yeah. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, it really was, man. And I'm looking forward to what you're doing with MPH.
Well, thanks for caring.
For sure. Thank you.
I really appreciate it.
Absolutely, right, man. Thank you for the music and thanks for the time.
Yeah, man. I really appreciate it.
Have a great day.
All right, Gary. You too.
Thanks, bye, man.
All right. Bye-bye. Take it easy, buddy.
The songs you heard on this podcast were all taken from the self-titled Havana 3 AM album, and they were What About Your Future, Reach the Rock, and Hole in the Sky. The Havana 3 AM album, as well as all of Gary Myrick's work, is available to stream wherever you stream your favorite music. Many thanks to Gary Myrick and Haley Winters. If you like us, please be sure to rate us. And if you like us even more, hit that little follow button and follow us. It really helps the crazy algorithms of the internets. Thank you very much. Abandoned Albums was recorded at Thunder Love Studios.
Produced and written by Keith R. Higgins and Rob Janicki.
Engineered and mixed by Steve Beasley. Edited by A.J. Royce.
Original music by Mike Pellegrino. If you like what you've heard, be sure to subscribe and follow us on social media. At Twitter, we are at Abandoned Albums. And on Instagram, we are at Abandoned_albums.
Many thanks to Bailey Leaf, Rob Janicki, S.W. Loudon, Michael Janicki, Steve Beasley, Mike Pellegrino, Therina Bella, Peyton Janicki, and of course, our executive producer,
Rufus Thunderwolf.
And now, until we meet again next time,
I remain as always obediently yours.
Abandoned Albums is a production of Pawprint Media.